Of WHD2 Chippewa Falls, W228EP Eau Claire,
and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Peter King. For residents in northern Gaza, there seems to be nowhere to run to, although Israel has ordered them to go south before it begins a presumed ground offensive. Israeli officials say Hamas will use residents as human shields if they don't leave. Correspondent Holly Williams reports it's not just a military battle, but a propaganda war.
Disturbing Hamas propaganda appears to show the militants mistreating their captives. For relatives of those taken, it's unbearable. Hamas claims 13 hostages held in Gaza have already been killed in Israeli airstrikes, which we cannot verify.
Officials say more than 100 people were on the first charter flight to carry Americans out of Israel. It landed in Athens just a few hours ago. CBS's Imtiaz Tayyab.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken speaking in Qatar says the U.S. is trying to ensure the safety of civilians.
Our focus now is on helping to create safe zones.
Tens of thousands of people around the world took to the streets today in support of Palestinians from Baghdad to Barcelona.
National security officials say at least 27 Americans have been killed since the fighting started. Others are unaccounted for. Here's CBS's Ed O'Keefe.
President Biden spent more than an hour speaking to families of the 14 American citizens still unaccounted for. A relative of Judith Tai Renan and Natalie Renan, who are believed to be held by Hamas but alive, according to the Israeli government, tells CBS News the Zoom meeting was positive, reassuring, and that the president shared our pain.
A month into the auto workers' strike, UAW President Sean Fain says the union will use the element of surprise for its next job action.
Today, we're not announcing expansion of our strike, but we are prepared at any time to call on more locals to stand up and walk out.
Ford and Stellantis, which owns Chrysler, both say they'll lay off more than 1,200 workers because of the strike. Ohio's Jim Jordan has won a secret ballot vote to become the latest hopeful to replace Kevin McCarthy as House Speaker. There's no guarantee that will get him the gavel. Dozens of his fellow Republicans voted against him. CBS's Natalie Brand.
As this race drags on, following McCarthy's ouster more than a week ago, House Republicans have expressed they're disappointed with their process.
There's some deep mistrust, there's some communication problems, and some things are jacked up.
While the timeline remains up in the air, House Democrats are urging their members to be ready to vote on a moment's notice. Natalie Brand, CBS News, Capitol Hill.
This is CBS News.
If you need to hire, you need Indeed, because Indeed's all-in-one hiring solution helps you attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one place. Visit Indeed.com/credit.
For Civic Media News, I'm James Kelly. The Eau Claire Public Library is seeking help to address concerns about the unsheltered population in the area. Charlie Schell, a member of the library's Board of Trustees, attended a city council meeting on Monday to ask for funds to help address concerns over incidents involving the unsheltered population at the library. He also said the library plans to hire a security guard and employees have done extensive training on de-escalating difficult-to-handle situations. U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin has joined a bipartisan group of senators calling for Secretary of State Antony Blinken to freeze $6 billion of Iranian assets. The calls come in the wake of the deadly terror attack in Israel and subsequent conflict. The group of senators cited Iran's longstanding support for Hamas and its history of supporting acts of terrorism through them as reason for the Biden administration to freeze the assets. For Civic Media News, I'm James Kelly.
Yeah, I'm looking at the pages right now.
Thomas's translation company just lost its only two Spanish speakers. Without the right replacements, he'll be in problemas.
Yeah, we'll have those ready. Tonight's gonna be a late one.
Indeed can help him hire great people fast.
I need Indeed.
Indeed you do. With Indeed Instant Match, we immediately show you quality candidates whose resumes on Indeed meet your sponsored job description. Visit Indeed.com/credit and get $75 towards your first sponsored job. Terms and conditions apply.
Have you noticed bad behavior has become normalized at interscholastic athletic events? Some fans seem angry. They lack civility toward one another. Some even get aggressive and unruly.
Time out. What is going on? This has to stop. Let's not forget, school sports aren't just about winning. And they're definitely not an excuse to take your frustrations out on the official or the opponent. They're about teaching lessons like perseverance, respect, and empathy, so students can learn and grow as people, not just as players. We all have a role to play in setting a good example for our students and teaching them these important values. So fans, it's time to step up your game and behave positively at Interscholastic Athletic Events in Wisconsin.
This message presented by the WIAA and the Wisconsin Athletic Directors Association.
It's never personal, only politics. The Devil's Advocates Radio Show with Dom and Crute.
Weekdays from 4 until 6
on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. This is 93.5 The Tap.
93.5
The Tap.
And share us planet-wide on the Facebooks, Mastodons, and sites still known as Twitter at Green News Report.
Are you tired of think tank approved corporate news and commentary? Are you tired of CEOs telling you what to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
728 billionaires hold more wealth than half of the nation. Stop and think about that for a minute. You got 728 people who have more wealth than half of the country. And you wonder why today, when Sean Fain did his Facebook Live talking about the Louisville Ford plant that generates $48,000 in revenue each and every minute of each and every hour of each and every day, 24/7, 365, year after year. Think about that for a second. In 1 minute, they make more than probably the average worker on that floor puts in their pocket for the whole year. And yet they're saying, hey, sorry, can't afford it. Wish we could help. Wish we could afford to, you know, to pay you all those things that you're asking for. But not so much. And you look at the situation, and I think Fain is spot on. This is a moment where working people have got to stand up. This is a moment when working people have got to go, enough is enough. It's time to redistribute wealth the way it used to be when our grandparents were around, when we had 35% union density, where we had a 92% top marginal tax rate, and where we were eating the rich. And here to share some thoughts on maybe how we get back to that and some of the news from the picket line, I've asked Jesse Kelly to come talk with us. She is a UAW Local 160 worker, also chair of their communications. She also holds an incredible podcast. Jesse, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you for having me back on.
So I heard this number, and again, 48,000. Fain hit this a couple of times, 48,000. Each and every minute of each and every hour of each and every day, that's a lot.
Yeah, 48,564, which is absolutely astronomical and just insane to think about. Absolutely insane to think about.
And then to tell you that, you know, hey, sorry, we can't meet your needs. We can't help you support your family with the labor that you do, the wealth that you're creating, the revenue your labor is bringing in. Sorry, can't share.
Right. And a lot of those people there are temporary employees, or they're the second tier workers that are making $16.67 an hour. That's it. And they're still generating $47,000 per minute.
Now, what I liked about what Sean Fain was talking about is this is much more than just your membership. this is a societal thing. This is about finally working people saying enough. He used the word working class a lot. It sounded like, look, it sounded like he could have sat in my chair and done the show for the last 18 years, because it's the stuff that I've been talking about for all of these years, that finally the working class of this country has to come together and demand better opportunities, better wages, hours, conditions, opportunities for their kids, for their communities. And I'm glad there's finally someone going, hey, you know what? Especially in a leadership position like as the head of the UAW, talking like this, you don't hear this, I don't think, near enough out of politicians or even labor leaders.
Yeah, I completely agree. And that's what we do it for, because it's not about us. It's even auto workers when we formed the union and the UAW started, like, it was about setting a standard of living inside of America for everybody. And it's about, you know, rising tides, raising all ships, not just our own. And I think you hit it right on the head when you said opportunity. It's about opportunity. And for a couple of decades now, there has been absolutely no opportunity. And when you do get a little bit of opportunity, that just leads to living paycheck to paycheck. And we're acting like that's the greatest opportunity in the world. And it's not, but that's what we're fighting for. We've been fighting for the crumbs, and it's been a race to the bottom. And it is. You really have to change society as a whole, and you have to have class solidarity, and you have to have class momentum and all of these things, because if we don't, we're just pitting ourselves against each other, and divide and conquer is their favorite strategy. And that's exactly what they'll do. So it really is it's a class fight right now, and it will be a class victory.
It seems that your president has adopted my idea of adopt a striker. Everybody finding a picket line, getting out there and marching on the picket line, bringing, you know, some water, some food, maybe a couple of bucks for the strike fund, but engaging not just members, but other union members, people in the community, because this really is about community. This should be about, as you said, rising tides, lifting all boats. And this is how they did it in the past. The hope is people will find a picket line and adopt a striker.
That is exactly the hope. And I think that they will. And that's what's so interesting about this strategic strike and the stand-up strategy, is that you do have some workers that are still at work making regular paychecks, and you have some of the brothers and sisters out on the line making 500. And we're in a really, really unique situation right now where we can make a sacrifice too, and we can kind of share the wealth of us working regular hours right now and trickle that down to them. And I think it's working, because I'm seeing some of these pantries, and these pantries are astronomical. They're way bigger than the 2019 strike against General Motors. They have enough things to sustain them for so long. And I love that. And even some of my coworkers on the floor the other day was like, we're going to go out and we're going to grill them steaks, because we're not bringing them pizza and we're not bringing them donuts. They deserve steaks. And we're going to go out there and we're grilling the best ones ever. And I just love to witness that and to see that, because they know that those people out on the line right now, they're making the sacrifice for us, and we'll benefit from that sacrifice. So we want to make the sacrifice back to them.
Especially now, because you've hit the month mark, right? I mean, this is, you know, these folks have missed a paycheck or two. We're now down the road where this is starting to become real. And this is becoming, you know, something that that is starting to hit the pocketbook a little bit, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the majority of our members, so they say 60%. I think that's even lower than what I would have projected. But they're saying 60% of our membership lives paycheck to paycheck. That means that they felt it immediately. The majority of our members felt it immediately and have already now in a situation where they can't pay their bills, or they can't pay their mortgage, or they're making the hard decisions of, do they feed their family this week, or do they pay the electric bill? And that's why we need to step up for them. And the good news is that we are. And tomorrow will be exactly 1 month into it. So we are asking every UAW member to go out there and every ally to go out there and walk the lines with these people. I was just down in Chicago and they haven't been on strike as long, but it's just amazing that when you walk up and you start shaking hands and you start introducing yourself, just how re-energized they get to see people that aren't in their local helping them out and standing with them and just being on the line with them and talking to them and wanting to hear how they feel.
No, I remember, you know, when I first started in the union, back when I was a young guy, an old timer who, you know, he fought the battles of the 50s and 60s. This was a guy who had the scars. And he said, look, you know, we used to go on strike every 10 years, whether we needed to or not, because of what you just said. When you get out on that picket line, you meet new friends, you connect with old friends, and people who were your enemies in the workplace then became your friends. It was the building of solidarity. It was the building of a common interest and a common unit. And you need to do that. And also, the things that you win in those strikes are things that you hold dear and you never give up. And I think, you know, we've had a couple of generations where we haven't fought for things. We haven't fought and won stuff. So it's easy to give the hard fought things up of the past. It's easy to give those up now. But now we're seeing, hey, we've got to fight for this stuff again because we've lost a lot of it.
Yeah. And it's frustrating. It's frustrating to be part of a generation that has to sacrifice and struggle and win back things that a previous generation already won at a bargaining table. But that is the reality of the situation that we're in. So that's what we have to do right now. But you're right. I mean, when you're out on that picket line, it just reiterates the fact and solidifies the fact of this is the side I'm on. And I love that question of being like, what side are you on? And while you're out there, you know what side you're on, you know what side your brothers and sisters are on. And it's the closest thing to magic I've ever felt.
No, and look, you know, it's like always, I say that I want people to go out to these picket lines. I want people to show support, honk as you're going by, make as much noise as possible, write letters to the editor, call politicians, do as much saber rattling, noise making, screaming and hollering, disrupting as you can, because the more of that, hopefully the shorter the strike. You know, the bigger the picket line, the shorter the strike was always the saying. So the hope is that on the 1 month anniversary, people do get out and participate. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're with Jesse Kelly. She's a UAW 160 member, also the chair of their communications part. She hosts a podcast. What's the name of your podcast?
Unity Gains.
Unity Gains. We will get links out on social media how you can take a look at that. Now, here's the thing. I listened to Sean Fain speak today, talked about changing tactics. In fact, taking the Louisville plant out was a change in tactic, kind of a surprise. I saw it. I'm like, wow, that was shocking. I wonder why. I now find out why, because Ford had basically backed up on some things. And they said, you know what? Here, we've given you the carrot of not taking things out on strike. Now here's the stick. Do we expect more of this coming up in the near future?
Hopefully. And yeah, we had to change the tactic and we had to change the strategy. It was much needed and it was perfect timing. I believe that, you know, we tried to do it the most diplomatic way in the beginning and we tried to organize ourselves, which is what it's all about. And we had a really good strategy, but then we noticed that, like he said, they thought they figured it out and they thought they won the game. So it became a matter of they started playing the game and they wanted to sit on their hands until Friday morning and then all of a sudden come with some lowball offer in hopes that they would avoid a strike. And that's not what we're doing here. That's not what the purpose is. That hurts our brothers and sisters out on the line. That hurts us. And we're just saying we want a fair contract and we want to bargain and it's not a game to us. And so we don't know why they're treating it like a game on their end. So, you know, if we had to change up the strategy, that was the idea and that was the plan. And that's exactly what we did. So now this is the expectation that we're holding you to. And if you are not coming and meeting us with that expectation, then we have to do what we have to do. And that means that we have to pull more people out to the strike line.
Yeah. I like what he said about get your checkbook out. The one that you use for paying your executives and paying off your Wall Street friends.
That's exactly it.
that is an incredible frame because I look at the checkbook that they use to pay their CEOs and $1 billion over the last 13 years have gone to the three company CEOs. Ford, their CEO has pocketed $377 million over that period. Stellantis, Fiat Chrysler, $372 million. And General Motors, $254 million. I got to tell you, I don't know how if you're making $250 million over the last, 13 years, what I said, how you can go, sorry, we can't give you a reasonable. I don't know how you do that. I don't know how you go. No, we're going to squeeze the eagle, the quarter till the eagle screams.
I mean, that used to be my biggest complaint. So I was a temporary employee for 3.5 years. And I remember when I was a temporary employee, they would march me and all my brothers and sisters into a room. There was 300 of us at the time. And they would march us into a room and they would brag every February about the earnings from last year. And they would say, aren't you guys so happy you're working for a multi-billion dollar corporation? Look at how good we're doing. Look at all of this money that we generated. And by the end of the meeting, when it's time for question and answers, it's like, awesome. We're working for a multi-billion corporation. When are you hiring us? When are you giving us the healthcare that we deserve? When are we getting our part of profit sharing? When are we going to have vacation times and the right to bereavement and jury duty pay? And that, you know, in the same breath, in the same half an hour meeting, they would explain, oh, then we're not competitive. And if we hire you, we're not competitive. We just can't do that. We have to make sure that we have money to invest in the corporations. And it's just insane. It's so insane, this double think and this double talk and how you can say one thing and then completely contradict itself just so to make more money, to justify why you are able to make more money.
Yeah, I mean, the question should be then, well, when does all of this money start to trickle down? I mean, we've given you massive tax breaks. We've given you all these benefits. We've done all this stuff. We've given massive concessions. We've done all this stuff. When does it trickle, or does it never trickle down? And the answer is no, it will never trickle down. Their pockets never fill. Their appetite for more is never suppressed. Their want, their need, their greed, never ending. But their want for you to sacrifice and tighten the belt, boy, they know how to ask for that.
Yeah. I talked to one of my sisters on the line this last weekend, and she came from a GMCH plant, which is Component Holdings. And she told me, she said, when we took concessions in 2008, she left work on a Friday making $28 an hour and went back to work on Monday making $18. And she's like, that was my concession, right? Like, I gave my concession, I gave my sacrifice, and this is why, like, I deserve everything that I'm asking for right now. And that's exactly right. And I mean, it never trickles down. It never trickles down, like you said, because you cannot satisfy corporate greed. You just cannot. It will never be enough.
So what's the final message to the people on the picket line right now? I mean, give me some good words.
Yeah, I mean, solidarity forever. And we're going to win this. And we're going to win this together. And we're all willing to sacrifice. So, I mean, the message is always solidarity forever.
The podcast Unity Gains, correct?
Yep, Unity Gains.
We will get links out on social media how you can take a look at that. Jesse Kelly, I appreciate you taking time. I hope you'll come back and talk to us again. But then again, I hope you won't, because I hope this is over. I hope the workers get what they earn, get back to work, supporting their families and supporting our communities. But one day longer, one day stronger. Jesse, appreciate the time.
Thank you guys so much.
I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. What do you think? Does it ever trickle down? Do you get this at the place where you work? Because I've sat through these meetings myself. Look how wonderful we're doing. And you go, how about us? When do we get some of that? The answer? Never. The second Tuesday of never. I'm going to take a quick break right back after this with your thoughts. Stick around.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
$1 billion over the last 13 years. $1 billion. That's how much they put in their pockets. Can you imagine that? And they say, sorry, in defense of the market, we need to keep wages down. Whose wages? clearly you're not talking about your wages. Clearly not that at all. Clearly not talking about the money that you're jamming into your pockets. It's amazing to me. And look, you know, this is the reason these folks are out on this picket line. This is the reason that workers are striking the way they are. This is the reason people have had enough. And look, understand, strikes work. No matter what they say, strikes work. Perfect example. We didn't get to get anyone from the Kaiser Permanente strike that went on for a couple of days last week, because it's over now. The 85,000 Kaiser Permanente healthcare workers have reached a historic tentative agreement. Going to improve patient care, going to improve patient safety, going to make critical investments into the system. Good stuff. And that happened. Why? Well, it happened because those workers went to the picket line. They are going to raise wages by 21% over the 4 years that are coming. And it's a way to retain some of the folks that they need. There will be a new minimum wage for healthcare workers in California of $25 an hour and $23 an hour in the other states. And going to protect the work of the nurses to stop subcontracting and outsourcing so that you can keep people who know what they're doing and who know where the bathroom is. This is the thing. You know, why would you bring in, you know, contract nurses who, especially during work stoppages, why would you bring in these subcontractors or outsourced people who don't even know where anything is? They don't know the system. You haven't done any training. It's really crazy. Also, there's a bunch of initiatives that are going to get some investment to address the staffing crisis, because you got to bring new people in. They've got to streamline the hiring process. That evidently is going to happen because of this. There will be more training, more education. They're going to try and bring in more people through a mass hiring event. And commitment to taking people who start off, at the bottom and help work them their way up by investing in the future of these workers, by investing in the training. Now, look, my union represents a large hospital in the area. And the guy who's the business agent for those workers talks about, look, you get in at the bottom floor. You either work in food service or you're in the housekeeping. And then you can bid to the next job with your seniority. The longer you're there, you can bid to the next job. And with that comes the bit of training you're going to need to be able to do that job, because they believe in growing, people who are dedicated to the hospital and dedicated to the job, but also rewarding people for staying and wanting to get them to stay. This is something that, in this transactional employment situation that we find ourselves, where employers think people are disposable, this is the kind of stuff that needs to be fought for. I'm old enough to remember when you could have gotten a job, an entry-level job, sweeping floors in the mailroom or whatever, and worked your way into the next job. And that's because unions fought for that stuff. That's because people fought for bidding and seniority rights. I had someone tell me that story not too long ago, and tell me, well, it's a fantasy, that stuff doesn't happen. And I said, no, it's happened a lot. In fact, the former governor of New Jersey, John Corzine, was a guy who started off in the mailroom. I mean, it's a great story. And he became a really rich guy, worked his way all the way through. But we don't have those employers anymore. Now it's all about, they've taken what used to be on the job training and they've put it on the back of the schools. Now it's, we got to get these schools to get people the training that they need. We got to get the taxpayers to fund our employment needs. And look, every unemployment system across the country, I know in Pennsylvania, you've got, I think it's Job Corps is what they call it. It's a job search thing, but they also do some low-level job training, because employers just aren't doing it as much anymore. And to see this in this contract, to say, hey, maybe you do get a job in the in the housekeeping or food service or whatever, patient transport or whatever. And you do learn the next step. Maybe you become, a certified nurse, or maybe you could become an LPN or eventually become an RN. Maybe you work your way up and guess what? They fund it. Maybe even they're a big enough system, 85,000 workers. They're a big enough system that they could start their own healthcare university, that they could start their own education system to educate nurses and workers for their system. Could easily do that and wouldn't need to saddle the workforce with massive debt. You want to bring people into your job? Give them the opportunity, maybe an apprenticeship program. You know, like the building trades does. You know, I've been advocating for the building trades model in a lot of industries. You bring people in, you make them an apprentice, you pay them a reasonable salary so that they can at least get by while they learn the job, and then eventually they become proficient, eventually they become masters of their craft, and eventually they then teach the next generation. And then it just continues. But that would take some initiative. That would take some investment. That might take away from profit. And remember, in this country, the only thing that is sacrosanct is profit. They've even got working people thinking that way. But I think that's changing right now. I see it changing. And people have had enough. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Right back after this. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1985. That was the day that clerical and support staff at Columbia University went out on strike. More than 1,000 staff members were represented by the United Auto Workers, District 65. The workers wanted improvements in their benefits and their wages. They were also concerned by pay discrimination for women and minorities. 2 days before the proposed strike was set to begin, the workers held a rally. Trade union leaders spoke out in support of the clerical staff. In a show of solidarity among Ivy League schools, members of the clerical staff union from Yale University made the trip from New Haven, Connecticut to New York City to support the Columbia workers. The Yale union had won its first contract just the year before after a 10-week strike. The Yale delegation chanted, "We love you, 65. Oh, yes, we do. We whipped the Ivy League, and you can too." The strike lasted for 5 days. Some of the students formed the support group Students for a Fair Contract and helped pass out leaflets on the picket line. The Teamsters refused to cross the picket lines, stopping deliveries to the campus. According to the Columbia Spectator newspaper, the final contract included significant gains for the members. They won a 6% increase with retroactivity and additional hikes for minority workers, lower deductibles on medical insurance, and non-discriminatory clause and new technology language. The union's victory at Columbia was part of a wave of strikes by clerical workers at some of the nation's top schools. Stanford University went on strike in 1974 and 1982. Cornell's staff held 3 strikes during the 1980s. The workers who run these elite, well-funded institutions were standing up for their rights as workers.
Here's my suggestion for stopping the ultra-right-wing loopiness coming out of the mouths of Republican officials. Hearing aids. I'm convinced that the wacko blatherings of Matt Gaetz, the ravings of the QAnon cult, Trump's tantrums, and so many others are the result of a tragic neurological disconnect. This affliction lets their tongues wag impulsively, but their ears don't pick up the noise, so they're unaware that they are prattling nonsense. The current chaos in Congress's Republican caucus is one embarrassing example of this eardrum contagion, but it has spread throughout the country, even to local right-wing officials. In Shasta County, California, for example, the Republican-controlled Board of Supervisors recently lurched into full-tilt screwballism, frenetically warning that Japanese forces are weaponizing mosquitoes to be, quote, flying syringes to mass-inject Americans. See? No way they would have said that if they could hear themselves. Which brings us to the fount of present-day right-wing goofiness, Texas state officials. Their latest tone-deaf ploy is by Governor Greg Abbott, who wants to divert our people's tax dollars from public schools to exclusive private academies, subsidizing the rich class he serves. He's tried to do this before, but he fails, since even conservative Republicans in rural counties don't want their public education turned over to profiteering corporate chains. So this time, Greg is hyping privatization as a, quote, religious freedom issue, piously preaching that, quote, God created us to have family units, not state bureaucrats, make decisions for families. This is Jim Hightower saying, sheesh, does Abbott even have ears? Or maybe he's hoping that we don't have memories, for we have heard him howling constantly that the state, not families, must make every woman's personal reproductive decisions. Let's buy a hearing aid for him and set it on a constant replay loop.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, really twisted story over at the Washington Post today. I gotta tell you, it's just one of those things that makes me go, what is wrong with us as a society? And I know lots wrong. But the headline is, you know, how 91 felony charges boosted Trump's standing in the GOP. And one of the things that they led with is, evidently went to the Iowa Faith and Freedom Dinner last month and asked some people questions. And one of the guys that they asked a question to is, you know, why do you basically, you know, why do you like Trump? Why are you involved in this? You know, all this stuff. And he said, look, you know, the people that don't like him, you know, when they dislike him, it helps me like him more. If they'd ignore him, I probably wouldn't like him as much. And it asks, does that make sense? And the answer is no, that doesn't make any sense. Unless it's just your personality to want to be the contrarian. If everybody else is going, no, he's a criminal. No, he's broken the law. No, he's done all these horrible things. And you go, no, he hasn't. Maybe if that's your personality, I guess it makes sense. But no, it doesn't. Sorry. Anyway, here to maybe help me work through this. Maybe this is where we start. Maybe help me work through this. So this is why I've asked my good friend, former Ohio congressman and political analyst Bob Ney to come share some thoughts. Bob, thanks for taking time for us.
No, thank you, Rick.
So does this make any sense?
Okay. David Alexander, that's the engineer who attended that freedom dinner, okay? Yeah, he starts out, Trump's arrogant, he's egotistical, and he praised all the other candidates. Then he turns around and says that the people that don't like him, when they dislike him, it helps me like him more. So he completely turned around and went another direction. Now, kind of doesn't make sense, but I think what he's saying is he's buying into, you know, he's at the Freedom Dinner or whatever. He's buying into the whole deep state. So you don't like Trump, but the deep state steps in, and now the system's against Trump, and they're trying to stop him as a candidate for president. And that's what this is about. So it's the psychology of, you know, pity me because I'm right, but big government's trying to take me down.
Yeah.
That's the only way I can kind of translate that.
No, that's the, you know, that's where my mind is, and it's why he plays the martyr card every chance he gets. And look, no one plays the victim like Trump does. Honestly, you look at, he's a rich guy who's never done an honest day's work in his life, and somehow he's always the victim.
Right, and now it's up to the 91 counts. Now, what amazes me is the strength that he, well, doesn't kind of amaze me as much, but the strength that he has gotten off of this, because people say he's being picked upon. Now, at one point in time, you do stop, not you, but plurality, you do stop and say, you know, maybe 40 counts would have been enough, you know, maybe 50. When it gets to 91, it starts to be able to be a plausible theory thrown out there by Trump that, you know, they just really want to make sure I'm not the president because I'm the right guy.
Yeah, so, no, or they're just piling on. Or
right,
the other part
overboard
is He just broke a lot of laws.
There you go. Same thing. But it all came at once. So when it first started out, it was like, okay, yeah, he did this, or maybe he mishandled the documents or whatever. Then as it grew and grew and grew, I think that's when the tide turned, that it's, you know, that it was some kind of concerted effort, because it all came, even though it's not, because it all came at the same time, you know, took a couple years. Now, on the other hand, what kind of really blows my mind, though, is the fact that he's in the run in the polling against Biden. That in itself, it says that, I think what it says is that a lot of the independents are who would turn on Trump and who are toxic to Trump for other reasons are potentially staying home. And it's about voter turnout. You know,
or we're at least a year away from, a little over a year away from the next election.
Yeah.
Most people have lives. They're doing other things other than, you know, playing the horse race politic of the presidential race. And the Republicans have a primary. And, well, I think if you want to call it a primary, and there's some energy on that side, you know, because, you know, there's something there. As we're Democrats and, you know, Biden supporters are going, hey, I got a life. I trust what the guy's doing. He's doing a good job. There's not chaos every day. You know, could it be that? Could it be they're just not paying attention?
Part of it could be they're not paying attention. Then part of it could be that they're just not satisfied no matter what he does at this point in time. At this point in time.
Because they're Americans.
So let's take a Democratic voter who's really kind of like, I'm a little weak on Biden-Harris. I've got other things I'm doing. I'm not impressed with them. So in the polling situations, I'm kind of like, you know, maybe we need another candidate. Now, as the dust settles and there's a candidate, which could be Trump or could not be Trump, but as it settles and it's Trump versus Biden, straight, you know, head-on collision next election, then maybe those voters will come home. Yeah. I had it happen, Rick, I had it happen in my elections. I never polled for issues. I don't like polling, and then that's my issue. But I polled for where I was standing. And at one election, you know, the independents were, they were just not there, right? And so by election day, we made, enough of an effort that independents came home, because my district was 16% Republican index. We had our Democrat base that helped us, which is great, but we needed those independents. And they weren't there. And it was scary. And my pollsters are like, you know, you're in trouble. Well, by election day, when it came down to me and another opponent, we did the right things to get the message out, and they came home. This could be the same thing in this presidential election. Yeah.
We'll see. Because, look, at the end of the day, I think Biden, for me, has exceeded expectations, especially with everything that he's done on the labor side of things. I couldn't, you know, the only thing I could ask for more is to actually, you know, get some legislation passed. But with a dysfunctional House of Representatives, Bob, none of that's going to happen. So I got to ask you, you know, with all of your time that you spend in Congress, have you seen anything this entertaining?
Never. And, you know, I'm watching also members in the meantime doing things that on other issues, just I hate to even get into it, you know, but just doing things and saying things. And Lindsey wants to now bomb Iran, you know, Lindsey Graham. And I'm like, suit him up. Give him an airplane. Let him go. Fly over there, the Lindsey Graham special. And I'm looking at all of this, and there are House Republicans. I've talked to a couple of members, you know, who messaged me, and there are House Republicans that realize that there are, you know, they're in the middle of a meltdown, a potentially fatal political meltdown that could literally, absolutely guarantee they don't have the House in 2024. They'll lose in the election, especially the centrist, you know, Republicans. And then there are those in that House that don't care. Now, why can I criticize them more? If you're a Marjorie Taylor Three Names, and if you're a Matt Gaetz, and if, you know, you're part of the crowd that's really not going to accept anybody, and you're standing up, quote, for your principles, and you really believe you are the right, correct ones, why would you not have the foresight to to realize what you are doing is going to make Speaker Hakeem Jeffries in 2024. And it's because they aren't there for the right reasons. They aren't there because they're standing up for principle. They're there for entertainment and personal purposes. That's why.
Yep.
Otherwise, this wouldn't be happening.
No, no, I absolutely 100% agree. And sadly, you know, we're just with all the chaos around the world and here at home, I agree with Michael McCaul, you know, the Republican from Texas, who's saying, look, you know, there are threats around the world, and one of the biggest ones is in that room, meaning his Republican Party.
Well, and they kind of had a deal, you know. Scalise, if he won, Jordan supports him and was going to nominate him. They had that deal, sort of a, hey, we're going to pick whoever wins out of this caucus.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that. Because it's my understanding that Norm's being, you know, you come out of that caucus, you've agreed that this is going to be our guy. Everyone kind of coalesces around the majority won. Elections matter. And it's just, you know, the vote kind of just a formality kind of thing. How often have people come out of these conferences, these caucuses, with their nominee and then not get the votes on the floor?
Never in my lifetime.
Yeah, see, I was trying to find this.
Never.
And I'm going, you know, the norm is you respect the election. So again, I'm looking at the chaos that they're causing, and you know, all of the norms of the past, they've just destroyed. And the sad reality is we're normalizing chaos.
Well, let me tell you real quickly how Denny Hastert became the speaker. I was sitting there. Livingston got tape recorded, you know, or video recorded on this affair. So he stands in front of us. I'll never forget it. We're about to go upstairs. We are about to go upstairs and elect him. And he stands there and says, I'm taking myself out of this race. And we're like, what? And people are yelling, no, no. And he said, no, I have a personal situation. I'm taking myself out of this race. Believe me, I just have to do this. And we're sitting there. And people are then starting, he leaves. People are starting to throw out names. You can see it is just going to be chaos city. Dave Hobson of Ohio, he was a former congressman, started a letter down the row, and he hand wrote it, and it said, we want Denny Hastert. He started that down the row, and people started signing it, just signing it. Then other names were being kind of yelled out because there was no formal process. It didn't matter. There were other names. They didn't want Hastert. They want, you know, Tom DeLay wanted it and all those things. And it ended up, no matter what the minority amount of members in the caucus that didn't want Hastert, didn't matter. Everybody went, okay. You know, everybody raised their hands. That's how it was done. And we put Hastert in. That's just an example of not people being lemmings and following along. It's an example of you take your best shot in the caucus, and if you don't win, you go with what's best for the caucus, which is who the majority picks.
Yeah.
That's how it always happens. This is this McCarthy, and now this is the first and second time. Now, Scalise, I had said the other day I thought Scalise would beat Jordan. I had said that. Then Trump comes out. Oh, Scalise, he's got cancer. You know, Trump comes right out and throws a match in the middle of everything.
Leave it to Trump.
That's what he did.
No, but here's the thing, and this is where, hearing you tell this is, you know, you do your pie fighting behind closed doors. You don't take it in. You don't take it out into the public.
You know, Steny Hoyer at one time ran against Nancy Pelosi. I remember the race well. Steny was my ranking member of House Administration. I remember the whole race. He's running. He's aggressively trying to get votes. Nancy's aggressively trying to get votes. Steny was doing good. At the end of the day, Nancy won. They didn't. No one came along and defected on Nancy. And you can say, well, they just go along with the crowd. Well, you know what? That's what you do when you have inter-caucus elections. The majority wins. And you don't then try to take down, you know, the person that won, which is exactly what the Republicans are doing. Neither party has done that historically for years, because you see what you get when you do it.
Yeah, but here's the thing. You just hit on it. You know, you believed in elections before. These are a bunch of election deniers. So they don't even believe in the election results that they were in control of.
Of their own caucus, right. And I also think there's the self, and Gingrich actually hit it on the head. I think there are X amount of members that they don't care about being in the majority. You know, he didn't go that far with it. I will. They don't care. They're out there for personal reasons.
No, I said they don't want to be in the majority because they don't have any ideas. They don't want to do the actual work. They want to be the minority because it's easy to sit on the sidelines and throw bombs and blow stuff up. That's easy. I think you're right. There are some who want to be in the permanent minority because it gives them that power to say no and the attention that comes with it.
Right. A couple of Republican members have actually privately said that that's what they think. These people aren't. And you know how everybody says career politicians, like it's such a filthy word. These people are not what we'll call career politicians. I'll call it people of substance with public policy, you who actually want to make public policy.
Yeah.
These are people that have come in and they just, you know, they want the 5-minute thrill. They want to, you know, get on the national media and be outrageous so that the national media then will follow them around, you know. Till the national media has had their day with them, and then the corporate media takes them out. You know how that runs.
Or they get a gig on one of the cable news channels.
Right.
Think Trey Gowdy.
Sure. Right, exactly. Right.
And finally, I got to get your thoughts on the George Santos debacle. I guess Wednesday, Republicans were supposed to move a resolution to oust him. That didn't happen. He had a meltdown today over being confronted about Israel. He did not take that well. He looks like he's melting down a little bit.
Yeah, he had what was the mystery baby thing?
I have no idea.
Okay.
I don't know I don't know who in their right mind would hand that man a 2-month-old baby.
I was just going to say, you know, where did the baby thing come from? Is that a prop? Do you rent them or what? Anyway, yeah, I love to, you know, do what we're about in America, which is to say, you know, innocent till proven guilty. And Santos, I can't say it. I mean, he used the corporate credit card and charged all kinds of things that he wanted to. And he lied, you know, on the money he put in, and he was making $8,000 a year, and he said he put a half. I mean, he's done. But it's going to be hard for them to throw him out. And here's why. If they are able to oust him before the trial commences, then somebody else, let's say, who gets in trouble and it's an iffy case, well, they almost have to oust them too. You know, you can't just determine this is the ugly case, this is the iffy case. The iffy case, we won't oust them, we'll wait till the process unfolds. So they're kind of stuck with this. Otherwise, they're going to set a precedent that every time somebody's indicted, and maybe, you know, there has been a history here and there of indictments that were haywire, and if that happens, then they would just throw everybody out automatically. So that's their dilemma on that, you know. But he's done.
Yeah.
I mean, he's done. He's going to go away.
Maybe he'll share time with Bob Menendez.
He won't. He won't have any babies to hold.
He may. Never mind. Not going there.
No, don't go there. But that mystery baby. You can't make this stuff up.
No. While everything's burning and everything's in chaos, at least we can laugh. At least we still have that, right?
A little bit. Yes, sir.
There you go. Appreciate the time, Bob. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Our good friend, Bob Nabe. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Going to take a quick break. Right back to wrap things up. Stick around. Listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 2000. That was the day that newspaper carriers for the San Jose Mercury News ended their walkout. 80% of the newspaper carriers were Vietnamese immigrants to the United States. Many were elderly or recent immigrants with families. The paper carriers often had to get up in the wee hours of the morning to complete their routes. They earned about $6 an hour. The carriers would also have money taken from their paychecks for the people on their routes who were delinquent in paying for their papers. San Jose is part of the tech industry growth of California's Silicon Valley. The economic disparity between the rich and the poor and working class in the area is stark. The newspaper deliverers were classified as independent contractors, meaning they legally had no protections and could not join a union. They knew that they had to work together if they wanted to improve their wages, their hours, and conditions. One carrier explained that the workers' concerns were, quote, thrown in the garbage by our supervisors. The carriers appointed John Howe as their spokesperson. They demanded a 20% raise. When management would not listen to their demands, carriers on nearly 50% of the routes stopped delivering the newspapers. The walkout lasted 6 days. At the peak of the action, nearly 50,000 newspapers had gone undelivered. 557 carriers participated in the walkout. Finally, management agreed to a 12% raise. They also agreed to end the practice of garnishing wages for delinquent subscription fees. The paper also reinstated 4 workers who had been fired due to the walkout. The newspaper carriers had shown the power of collective action. Extra, extra, read all about it. Workers stand together and win better wages, hours, and conditions. Now that's a headline worth reporting. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com. So Philip Esformes, you may remember that name, as Trump was leaving office, granted him clemency. Evidently, Mr. Esformes was one of the, evidently was engaged in one of the largest fraud schemes in healthcare history. An enormous scandal. And was tried, convicted on a number of counts. Was 5 years, less than 5 years into a 20-year sentence. And of course, Trump bailed him out. Now, this is a guy who lived the high life. Beach house in Miami, luxury cars, designer clothes, high price escorts, something Trump knows a little bit about. He walked out of federal prison, thanks to Donald Trump. Now the Justice Department is going back and charging him with the charges that he wasn't convicted on, that had no verdict. Evidently, the jury was unable to come to a verdict on six charges, including the most serious of the charges, which is conspiracy to commit healthcare fraud. This is kind of a big freaking deal. Now, the question, and this is the weird thing, because in the past, it's one of those things, you let sleeping dogs lie. We've allowed presidents to pardon people and grant clemency so that people get out of jail, and you just leave it alone. Well, the Biden administration's going back and going, wait a second. This kind of is one of the largest ever healthcare scams in the history of the country. And why not go back and charge what he's still able to be charged on? Now, the things he was convicted of and granted clemency for, those are done. That you can't touch those. Now, what's interesting is the right-wing talk radio, right-wing cable news, the blogosphere, the Trumps, the red hats. They're all going, this is the deep state. The deep state's going after poor Mr. Esformes. And look, it's an interesting thing because, you do want to honor the presidential powers, even if sometimes you go, wait a second,
That seems a little, I don't know, self-serving. Seems a little questionable because it's supposed to be that the president is able to right wrongs. That if someone was, you know, convicted and they maybe shouldn't have been, or there was a questionable conviction, you know, if there were things that, you know, I don't know, was no real evidence. You know, we hear a lot of these murder trials based on, you know, circumstantial evidence and eyewitness testimony, you know, the least reliable testimony of any type of testimony. You know, you could go, okay, well, we're gonna grant clemency to someone who spent 20 years in jail for a murder that maybe they didn't commit, that all the evidence points that it probably wasn't them. That's what it's supposed to be for. Not ensuring that your rich buddies get to go back to criming. Now, as for me, someone who goes, you know, I want rich criminals held accountable. You go, yeah, I kind of want this to happen, but I also go, you know, this is, again, we're destroying norms of the past. So I'm curious, you know, which side of this are you on? Do we go after the big fraudster and hold him accountable again, or do we allow sleeping dogs to lie and allow that presidential power to exist? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com, because I'm on the fence about this.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap,
WCFW HD2 Chippewa Falls, W228EP Eau Claire,
and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.